From Hospice UK and Dying Matters, this is the Dying Matters podcast. I'm your host, Eleanor McConnell. What would you do if you found out you only had a few weeks left to live? It's probably one of those questions that most of us have asked each other at some point just for fun. The kind of question best suited for road trips, or two-thirds of the way down a bottle of wine. For most of us, it's a fun hypothetical. Not really focusing on the idea of dying, but instead on what matters the most to us right now. It's basically a way of asking, what would you do if you didn't have to care about the future anymore? But for some people, that question is not about the hypothetical scenarios. It's not an opportunity to discover yourself or rediscover what truly matters. It's a practical and necessary reaction to receiving a terminal diagnosis. Ian Leach, my guest this week, never expected to have to discuss that question. But when his daughter, Mel, was told that her condition of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma was terminal, leaving her with only a few weeks to live, he found that he had to, no matter how difficult it was. Since Mel's death in 2008, Ian hasn't stopped having that conversation. Instead, he actively seeks it out. Ian is now Community Engagement Manager at St. Giles Hospice, and a lot of his work is centred around changing attitudes to death, dying and bereavement in his local community. I asked him why, given the pain of what he had been through, he was still so determined to ask the difficult questions.
I never used to. I always used to sort of joke about it. I suppose it was a nervous, jokey sort of, it was my way of dealing with it. And then following the death of my daughter in 2008, we had conversations with her, which were the sort of conversations really that no parent should ever have with their child, but they were probably some of the richest conversations that I've ever had. And she talked about how she was dealing with her own life-limiting illness. She talked about her death. She talked about her funeral wishes. What she wanted, what she didn't want, all that sort of thing. And I remember thinking after her funeral that actually the only person missing from her funeral in our lives was Mel. And that probably sounds obvious, but actually she planned her funeral to such an extent that it was almost like a party that she wasn't invited to. And it made me realise as well that it had made things so easy for us. We didn't have to think about it. She talked about it. I think all we had to decide was the number of cars we wanted rather than, you know, what music she would have wanted and everything else, really. So even down to her personal possessions, she talked about who she wanted those to be distributed to. So it just made me realise that actually, yeah, this has made things so much easier. So from that, coupled with the fact that she had really good end-of-life care, it made me, I don't know whether I want to talk about it all the time, but I'm comfortable talking about it, and I encourage other people to. But I think it's a choice. It is ultimately a choice. I think if you don't want to talk about it, then that's fine. That's your right, and that's your choice. I suppose I, through my work and through volunteering with NCPC and now Hospice UK and Dying Matters, I think what I do is I present the case for the defence or the prosecution, whichever side you want to look at it.
Mm. And so was it Mel who started those conversations?
Yes, she was in a aromatherapy-induced sleep. And she woke up one night from this very deep sleep. And myself and my younger daughter, Becky, and my wife, Julie, were watching television. And all of a sudden, Mel started talking about not being able to make up her mind whether she wanted to be buried or cremated. And this conversation came from nowhere. We'd not talked about it before. We'd had some very difficult conversations. The sort of conversations where she would talk about how scared she was, scared of being in pain, scared of dying, and all that sort of thing. We'd had those conversations, but nothing about her actual wishes. And so it would have been very easy when I look back for us to say, oh, we don't want to talk about this or we don't need to talk about this. Mm-hmm. But obviously she wanted to talk about it. I can't honestly say that we'd have approached the subject if she hadn't have done.
Yeah.
So thankful that she did. And so she decided that she would like to be cremated because she didn't like the thought of being buried alive. And, you know, I did point out that people are dead when they're buried. They're not buried alive and this sort of thing. And again, it's this most bizarre conversations and you probably say some of the most inappropriate things, but it doesn't matter. She then talked about donating her body to medical science and decided that they wouldn't want her because she was, in her words, she was damaged goods, which was interesting because that was obviously the way she felt about herself. And actually, with her illness, she died from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And with her illness, they would have probably found out more from Mel than they would have done from a lot of people. And I always find it strange, actually, that nobody ever contacted us after she died to talk about her lifestyle and things like that, because, you know, she was a young, relatively healthy 19-year-old girl when she was diagnosed. So we had this conversation anyway about medical science. And then the thing about Mel was she loved her football. She was absolutely mad on football and mad on Liverpool Football Club. And I always say, as a dad, I got most things right, but I completely failed where football was concerned, because I'm an Everton fan, and anybody who knows their football will know that they're, you know, very close rivals. So I joke I could compete with most things, but not Michael Owen. And so Mel became a Liverpool fan, but we both followed our local team, Burton Albion. Anyway, in this conversation, Mel then decided that she'd like her ashes scattered in Fernando Torres's back garden. And Fernando Torres at the time was Liverpool star. And so I said what any dad would say. I said, Mel, what happens if he moves house? Again, stupid thing to say, really.
No, that's so good that you thought of that.
And she said, I'd not thought of that. And then I dared to suggest that he'd move club, and I said, what happens if he leaves Liverpool? And she said, oh no, he'll never leave Liverpool, he'll always play for Liverpool. He's since played for Atletico Madrid, Chelsea, and maybe other clubs as well. So we didn't go down that route. And then she said, well, what about what about in the lake at university? And Mel was studying at the time she was diagnosed. She was studying at Aston University. And if you Google Earth Aston University, you'll see there's a heart-shaped lake there. And she said, you know, the lake at Aston University. And then I reminded her what students did in the lake in Aston University after a night out, and she very quickly went off that idea. So we were just having this stupid, bizarre conversation. She then said that, Becky, her younger sister, suggested that she could have some of her ashes in Burton-on-Trent and some of them in Birmingham, so where she lived and where she studied. And Mel replied, Becky, I'm not having me boobs in Burton and me bum in Birmingham. So again, totally, you know, totally bizarre, but so rich, as I say, so rich. She then decided that she wanted a bench, a memorial bench by the lake at the university. So we said we'd sort that out. She said then she wanted Robbie Williams to sing at her funeral. I said, I don't think we'll get Robbie, but I think, you know, we could play his music. And so she set about choosing the music for her funeral, and she chose Angels, which was her favourite song. I know it's one of the most popular songs at funerals, but it was her favourite song. She chose You'll Never Walk Alone, obviously, because of the Liverpool connection. And she also felt that there should be a hymn for the oldies, as she put it. And so she chose All Things Bright and Beautiful, because that's the only hymn that she could remember from school. So she then decided that she'd like people to wear bright colours, football shirts, but not Manchester United, because she did have some standards. And again, those were her words, so apologies to anybody who's listening who's a Manchester United fan. So that was it, really. And, you know, we held the funeral just under a week after she died, and people wore football shirts, they wore bright colours, they listened to Robbie Williams singing Angels, and that was it. You know, she also told us some of her possessions that she wanted to go to certain friends. So we sorted that out. And 3 months, about 3 months after she died in August, on the 19th of August, what would have been her 21st birthday, we unveiled her bench at Aston University. Mm. So, yeah, it was, and it's because of that conversation, really, that I now say to people, you know what, if you're in that situation, have the conversation, because if nothing else, you will make it so much easier for the people that you leave behind. And that was one of the things about Mel as well. She was, particularly in the last few weeks of her life, she was very worried about us. I mean, she was dying of this horrible disease, but she was worried about how we'd deal with things, how we'd look after ourselves. And I think, if you like, one of the most, you know, sort of selfless things she did was to tell us what she wanted, because then we didn't have to think about it.
Yeah, it sounds like she made it quite easy for you in a way.
Yeah, a lot easier than it would, you know, a lot easier than it would have been. You know, I remember driving out of, you know, we live in a cul-de-sac, and I remember driving out of a cul-de-sac on the day of her funeral. And we were laughing, and, you know, we were having a joke about something. I can't quite remember what it was. But I think part of that was because it had been made sort of so easy, and, you know, or a lot easier for us. It's never easy, but, you know, with a child. But yeah, that's sort of taken me to where I am now.
Yeah. How do you think we can help people's families start those conversations?
I do think it all boils down to choice, and I think it's never easy. There's never a right time. There may always be a wrong time. I think if the conversation, as it was in Mel's case, is initiated by the person who's dying, I would say go with it. Don't shy away from it. As much as it may hurt, as much as it may be difficult, go with it, and, you know, and let them talk. But if they haven't, then I think it is just sitting down, getting the right literature, getting the right information. I had a lady, you know, who spoke to me once, and she said, "Oh, my dad's dying and he won't talk. He really won't talk." And my suggestion to her was, you know, get one of the sort of Dying Matters leaflets, and just leave it at the side of the bed, and just see what happens. He'll either tear it up, he'll ignore it, or he'll read it. And as it was, he read it. And she came back to me a few weeks later to say, oh, it was great. They'd had the conversation and he'd read it. And sometimes it's about letting people have the conversations in their own time, and not forcing the issue,
yeah,
but supplying them with the information and say, look, you know, it's here, read it in your own time, and then maybe we can talk about it, you know, we can talk about it sometime. But also having the respect that if they don't want to, then yeah, that's fine. You shouldn't force anybody, you know, to have a, and you can't force anybody to have a conversation that you don't want to have. And I think sometimes people do actually know their funeral wishes, but they don't tell people. Mm. So they it's almost like they process it in their heads, but they can't sort of verbalise it. I'll tell you a story. My mother-in-law, about three months after I started at St Giles, asked me what I did. And I used to sum up my job as saying, well, I go out and about and I talk to people in the community about St Giles, and I destroy the myths around hospice care. And I also try and get people to talk more openly about death, dying, and bereavement. So I said to her, you know, that's what I sort of said, that's what I do in a nutshell. And I said, you know, things like your funeral wishes and you know, that sort of thing, what you want. And she said, oh, I don't like to think about that. I don't like to talk about that. And I said, well, you don't have to talk about it all the time, but, you know, it's just so that people know, oh, I know what I want doing. I know what I don't want doing. And then she went on to tell me this story, and I should explain again the football thing in the family. My mother-in-law works in the director's room at the local football club, and has done for years, probably about 50 years. And she has decided that when she dies, she wants her ashes putting under a little piece of astroturf at the end of the players' tunnel, so that when the players run out on a Saturday, she can look up and cheer them on their way onto the pitch. And I said, well, yeah, that's what I do. I said, have you ever told anybody? She said, no. So I said, well, if you haven't told anybody, nobody's going to know. But I have since done quite a few presentations at the football club to their community group, and I make sure now that they know. So they all know what my mother-in-law's wishes are. And hopefully it won't happen for a long time yet, but at least it's that thing about knowing what it is that people want. And, you know, the same with wills. You know, why wouldn't you, you know? I think you often hear people say, oh, well, I've got nothing to leave. But actually, everybody's got something. You know, it might not be, it might not be anything of monetary value, but actually of sentimental value and things like that. We've all got things. And, you know, Mel was a penniless student, but she still had things that she wanted her friends and family to have. And again, it sort of reminds me of a quick story. I was traveling down on a train to a Dying Matters event, actually. They asked me to speak at a conference. And I was traveling down on this train. And normally people don't talk to each other on trains. So I was quite surprised that I'd struck up a conversation with this lady. And she said to me, she said, "Oh, you know, where are you going?" And I said, "Well, I'm going down to London." And so, "Oh, really? What are you doing? Are you going on a trip? Or are you working?" I said, "Well, actually, I'm going to speak at a conference." And she said, "Oh, what are you going to speak about?" I said, "Well, why we should talk more openly about death, dying, and bereavement." And she said, "Oh, I don't like to talk about that." I said, "Well, it's about, you know, making wills and things like that. That sort of thing." And she said, "Oh, I don't like to think about that. And I said, "Well, isn't it interesting? Because actually, I've made a will and I don't think about it, whereas you haven't. And it plays on your mind whenever somebody mentions it." And I then said to her, "Where are you going?" And she said, "Oh, I'm going down to Milton Keynes. I'm going to the prison." It was to work there that she was going. And it was quite strange because we sat up opposite each other, sort of smiling. And she thought she got the best deal. And I thought I got the best deal. But it is that, you know, it is that thing again that people often sort of with wills, you know, they think, "Oh, I'll get round to it. But actually just do it. And once you've done it, you don't think about it. Mm. You know, the only time you have to think about it is if you want to change it for any reason. I only started, thinking about it, but I only actually made my will when I'd started at St. Giles, because I felt that actually I was going out and talking to people and telling them that, you know, they should make a will. So I ought to make one myself. So, you know, it's that's sort of moral thing. But interestingly, the same with the advanced care plan. I filled out an advanced care plan. And obviously I'm not in a position where, you know, I've got a life-limiting illness, but I just wanted to know what it would be like to fill it out. And it was quite interesting, really. It was it's good. And again, when you go and talk to people about it, you can say, "Well, I've done one and this is what I've put. You know, I put my favourite sandwiches, cheese and corned beef." Well, that's, you know, that's great. I don't want to be sat if I lose capacity. I don't want to be sat in front of a television watching rubbishy daytime TV. I like music. Music's my thing. So sit me by a window and give me a pair of headphones. And, yeah. You know, it's that sort of thing. And just to talk to people about that and, you know, and the care side of things and the, you know, it's about getting to know them as a person. And they then start opening up. I find they start opening up more. But yeah, I think it's just having those conversations at the right time. But it's also just making sure that if people are adamant that they don't want them, then you don't push them and you don't force them. It's about choice ultimately. And as I say, the case for the prosecution, if you like, is very strong. Have those conversations, make things easier. And it's a great thing that you can do if you do that.
Coming up next, I talk to Ian about some of the things he has tried at St. Giles Hospice to help people start those conversations. And I also have a go myself at trying similar methods with some of my own colleagues. Stay with us. If this conversation has got you thinking about how you really need to get your affairs in order before you die, Dying Matters can help guide you through the process. We highlight 5 tasks that can help you plan for the end of life. Some will be the work of a moment, others will require more careful planning, but ultimately you'll have 5 fewer things to think about before you die, and your loved ones will have 5 fewer reasons to worry. Those 5 things are... Number 1. Make a will. The obvious one. It's normally best to use a solicitor for this, and you can find one using either the Citizens Advice Bureau or through your local law centre. Just go to www.lawcentres.co.uk. Number 2, make a funeral plan. Think about what your funeral wishes are and write them down. It's even something that can go in your will. Did you know that you can pay in advance for a funeral? Sorting that out now is a great way to ensure that your family isn't burdened with expense or stress at a difficult time. You should be able to explore your options by getting in touch with a local funeral director. Number 3, start planning for your future care and support. This can be a really tough one to think about because there are so many potential scenarios to discuss, but it's a great idea to talk to your family and healthcare professionals like your GP about what care you'd like if you become dependent or seriously ill. This involves things like deciding where you want to be cared for, at home, in a hospital, hospice, or nursing home, whether there are any treatments you would refuse, and who you'd like to appoint to make care decisions for you if you are unable to do so. Number 4. Sign up as an organ donor. Other people can benefit from your organs after your death. If you're happy with being a donor, just go to www.organdonation.nhs.uk. That's something you can do right now. It should only take you about 2 minutes. Number 5. Ask your loved ones. Before you finalise anything, consider talking through your decisions with the people who are closest to you. It gives them an opportunity to input, and you the chance to talk to them about what matters most to you. Finally, write everything down, keep them in a safe place, and tell your loved ones where that place is. And now, back to Ian, to talk about how he went about helping his community to think about death and dying.
4 years ago, 2014, I started at the hospice in 2013. And Dying Matters 2014 was coming up, and I, if I'm honest, I wanted a quick win, and I wanted to do something for Dying Matters Week. I'd not been at the hospice long. I wanted to do something that would that people could look at that would have a bit of an impact within the hospice. So I came up with this idea of handing out like business type cards, and on it for the first year I did Before I Die. So I asked people what was top of their bucket list, and I'd hand them out at meetings, if I was speaking at conferences, I'd hand them out to, I was doing understanding bereavement workshops, I'd hand them out to people in that, to people in school, so a vast age range, and just asking people what was top of their bucket list. So we got some really interesting answers. We got a 16-year-old girl who said, "Before I die, I want my parents and grandparents to apologise for not seeing me." So what we discovered was really deep, people, really deep stuff. A lady in her 60s saying, "Oh, before I die, I want to be reconciled with my sister." We also had the "Before I die, I want to be rich. I want to drive a Ferrari. I want to own a Lamborghini. I want to own a big house," and all that sort of thing. A lot of materialistic stuff. A lot about travel as well. So that was the first year. And my idea was to sort of put this this board with all these cards on. In our education area at the hospice, with some Dying Matters leaflets, and just let people come and have a look at the board. What we found was that in the week of Dying Matters Week and the week after, that we had a real interest in the board. But not only that, people were taking the literature, and they were taking it in numbers that I don't think the hospice had seen before, because they'd not had anything like this before. So I decided to leave the board up there and sort of add to the leaflets every now and then. And then the second year, realised that if we're going to keep this up here, we've got to have another set of questions. So around sort of October time each year, I start with a new board. So the second year, I asked people how they wanted to be remembered. And again, very interesting. We had one 18-year-old lad who wanted to be remembered as the person who didn't want to live, but then realised he did and felt lucky. We had a couple of rude ones as well for how people wanted to be remembered, but that's fine. And that was great. We did that one. Third year, we asked people for their funeral song. So, again, very interesting. Frank Sinatra's My Way was the top one. Don't Stop Me Now by Queen was number two, and You'll Never Walk Alone was number three. Queen were the most popular artist. And we also had stuff like Going Underground, Burn Baby Burn, Come On Baby Light My Fire. And the weirdest one was the Birdie Dance, which, yes, you're frowning at me now. Google it. People of my age will know what the Birdie Dance is and know why. That's it, yeah, where you do the actions, which brought up all sorts of weird and wonderful things, images of funerals. So I did that. And then each year I have to think of a question. And at the time of thinking of the question for 2017, St Giles was looking at a brand change, and the strap line was changing it to "It's Your Life, and that's what matters." So I thought, how about asking people questions around that? So what is it that makes their life worthwhile? We'd ask them what they wanted to do before they die, but actually, what was it that made their life worthwhile? So I started handing out cards, and really interesting, again, that what people put. And again, this is a wide and varied age range. So I think the youngest person would be about 12, and the oldest person was probably in their 80s or their 90s. Not just hospital people from across our catchment area, people from across the country. And what we were getting this time was jumping in puddles with my son makes my life worthwhile. Mm-hmm. Sitting under a blanket with my best friend and laughing till we cry makes life worthwhile. I should say family, but shoes and clothes come a close second. Family, football and food, not necessarily in that order, make life worthwhile. My four-year-old son putting me on the naughty step makes life worthwhile. Walking with my dogs. Hearing my husband laugh from another room was a strange one, because I can sort of think, yeah, actually that would be quite nice, but then it's why the husband is in the other room. Is it because the person who wrote it doesn't want him in the room with them? And you know, you get, when you get these cards, whether it's Before I Die or whatever it is, you sort of think, oh, what does that mean? Are there, yeah, you know, is there more than one meaning?
They all tell a bit of a story,
and they all tell a bit of a story. And quickly going back to the Before I Die, we have a card on our board, our Before I Die board, that said, Before I Die, I want to see my granddad's grave. And I was standing by the board once, and there were three people looking at it. And one of them said, oh, look at that granddad. I bet he's a war hero, and I bet they want to go to France or somewhere and visit his grave. And, you know, and then the second person said, well, maybe they don't know granddad, and if they find his grave, then maybe they'll find out more about their family and their family tree and history and stuff like that. And the third person said, well, maybe granddad's not dead yet. Actually, maybe granddad's loaded, and when they see his grave, they know they're coming into some money. So it's great how people can look at one card and see three different things. But going back to the what makes life worthwhile, again, we had some absolutely fantastic responses, over 300, and it was great, because you know, here's us as a hospice saying it's your life, and that's what matters. And actually, we were finding out what matters to people. And it is the simplest things. It's, you know, sitting with my dog on my lap, my cat on my lap. And it sort of gets you thinking, well, actually, as a hospice, how, if, you know, if someone, what makes life, someone's life worthwhile is their cat sitting on their lap, well, their cat can come into the hospice and sit on their bed. And, you know, it's how you can make these things happen. And it is the simplest things. I think the big difference when I looked at the Before I Die, and when I looked at the What Makes Life Worthwhile, as I mentioned, Before I Die, there was a lot about travel and materialistic stuff. We, you know, we had the odd one that was very deep, but it was predominantly materialistic and, you know, travel stuff. So when you look at that compared to What Makes Life Worthwhile, it's like what people strive for is almost the materialistic things, but actually what makes them happy is the simple things. And the board continues to be there today. I always say what it enables us to do, which is fantastic, is actually to have conversations when we're not there, because we're very much about, you know, wanting people to have conversations and for us to, you know, to sort of help those conversations. But what we're doing is, you know, nobody will pick up a funeral wish leaflet if they're not going to use it, or they're going to give it to somebody, especially when they're not being handed it or pressured into getting it. When they're just standing in front of a board reading and then they pick up a leaflet, they're going to do something with that leaflet. So it enables us to have conversations when we're not there. It enables people to get talking and thinking. And for this year, on Dying Matters Week on the 14th, we're launching our latest board. And the question that we've asked this year is, what scares you? So it's what scares me. And again, some incredible stuff. We've had the obvious spiders and the rats. And I say the obvious spiders, and that's a bit dismissive, really. But again, if you're caring for somebody and their fear is spiders, in fact, Mel's fear was spiders, and she used to absolutely freak out when she saw a spider. And if you're thinking of somebody, you know, in a hospital bed or in a hospice bed, and they're attached to, you know, to drips and cannulas and stuff like that, and they see a spider and they start freaking out, that could have, you know, real impact. So it's about understanding that actually, yeah, this person, you know, they really do fear spiders. So we've had spiders, rats, snakes, that sort of thing. But we've also had somebody put, my mother-in-law's look scares me. Driving with my friend from Birmingham scares me. Driving in the dark scares me. But we've also had the dying alone. We've had some that just say death, but I think the majority that are related to death are the dying alone and being on my own. We had one lovely one where a lady put my husband dying before me, who will kill the spiders. Aww. So you actually get to somebody else, you know, the thought of not being reunited with my wife in the afterlife scares me.
Yeah.
So it's this thing, and it's I know our deputy CEO at the hospice, Sarah Riches, said it seems like we get more brave each year with the questions that we're asking. So I don't quite know what we're going to do for next year, but it is that we've sort of been on this journey of, you know, starting off with Before I Die, and now sort of 4 years down the line, we're asking people what scares them.
Yeah.
And it's good.
I think it's so awesome that you've started having those conversations, and not just in a way that focuses on death and dying, but I mean, just showing we can talk about it from so many different angles. You know?
Yeah, it's looking for ways in, and it's life at the end of it. You know, I always say death is actually the very last sort of nanosecond. Up until that, you're living. You know, you're living up until that very last nanosecond, and then you die, and that becomes death. Prior to that, you're living. So why wouldn't you have, you know, those conversations if you want to?
Exactly. Why wouldn't you? I was struck by how something so simple can really work to get people talking. And inspired by Ian's success, I decided to conduct a little experiment by asking a few of my own colleagues at Hospice UK what they wanted to do before they die. Here's what they said.
Before I die, I want to visit all the continents of the world.
Before I die, I would like to travel the 7 continents.
Before I die, I want to travel around South America and Central America and see the rainforest, see the Inca Trail, see all the amazing scuba diving opportunities, visit Peru, visit Chile, and see penguins.
Before I die, I want to write my own piece of music.
Before I die, I would like to climb Kilimanjaro and raise money for people with albinism in Africa.
Before I die, I would like to run around every football stadium in the UK.
Before I die, I would like to do the Asia leg of the Clipper race and to see live sumo.
Before I die, I would like to set up my own company.
Before I die, I would like to learn another language.
Before I die, I'd like to break a world record on Mario Kart Double Dash.
Before I die, I want to build a home and pass my fiddle on to someone who will appreciate it.
So, before I die, I want to visit Angkor Wat because I'm a massive ancient history geek. I would love to live in Barcelona again. I studied there in 1999-2000 at university. It was my golden year of youth. And I promised I'd return by the time I was 30. I'm nearly 40 now. So I want to go back there again. I'd like to go on a yoga retreat because I think it'd be wonderful to spend some time being very calm and kind of just having a wonderfully empty head. I'd like to visit Egypt because I'm a massive geek of ancient Egyptian stuff as well. And I'd like to stop worrying as well. That's it.
And that's also it from us. Thank you so much to my guest this week, Ian Leach. And thank you also to all my lovely colleagues who shared their Before I Die wishes with me. They're an excellent bunch, so I'm sure they'll manage to achieve them all. Thanks also to Bernadette Ryan for our theme music. Dying Matters is a part of Hospice UK, the national charity for hospice care. We have loads of great resources that can help you and your community to plan for the end of life. Just go to www.shop.hospiceuk.org. If you enjoyed our podcast, make sure you rate and review us on the iTunes store so that we can reach even more people and get everyone talking. Why not share your Before I Die wishes with us? You can get in touch on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Dying Matters.